Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Pure Dog Talk is brought to you today by PetMate Plastic Dog Crates, trusted providers of safety and comfort for your dog. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I am your host, Laura Reeves, and I have a really fun and different and fascinating guest for us today, and I think you guys are going to love this. This is my friend Steve Lehman. Steve is a falconer, and he hunts with falcons and pointing dogs, and he has trained raptors for nigh on 60 years now, and is a very sought-after speaker and author in this really kind of fascinating niche market that I think you guys are going to love. So a little bit of history, a little bit of dogs, this is going to be a good one. So welcome, Steve. Thank you for joining us.
Laura, it's good to talk to you.
And
excellent. We have dogs in common, which makes it even more fun talking to you.
I know. It's fabulous.
You have my Amsel, my dog part of my heart at your place right now.
That's right.
And I miss
That's
it.
That's right. Okay, so let's talk about, and I want to make sure I get this right, because it's not just falcons, right? There's goshawks and there's other birds of prey that we work with. So are we going to say raptors and dogs, or how are we going to talk about this?
Or it could even be predatory birds.
Okay.
Because I've worked with eagles, owls, hawks, falcons.
Fascinating.
And I've even had in past work with ravens and magpies, the whole corvid family.
Huh.
They've got a predatory part to them. And even Muscovy ducks are really fascinating.
Huh? This is cool. Okay, so, but generally this falls under the category of, we think of it as falconry.
That's right.
And so talk to us a little bit, because this is ancient. This is not a recent fascination of man. This is an ancient evolutionary fascination of man. Long before there were guns or bows and arrows or even nets, there were people who were acquiring their food by using birds of prey. So let's talk about that.
All right. Recently, I've had to wonder why, since the age of 8, 9, 10 years old, that this fascination with birds of prey happened to me. For me, I remember exactly when it happened. I was 8 years old in my mom and dad's car, and I saw a hawk swooping, and I now know it was a red tail, and I knew what it was doing. It was hunting, and it was going to catch and kill something. And I knew if I could get out of the car, I could follow it, and I could go steal that, whatever it had, and I could catch it and eat it. I happened to be hungry at the time. We were on the road driving, you know, little kids are hungry, you got to wait until you stop. So because of hungry, something really primal happened, and it took me until 11 that I actually pulled it off. I knew 3 pairs of red-tailed hawks, and I would run my parents' basset hounds along the creek with my pellet gun. And then I would tie the dogs up back at home, and I would go back over the track that it was on. And I knew that the red-tailed hawks would hunt in my wake, as I was chasing the rabbits kind of out of their territory and comfort, that they would need to sneak back because other rabbits would chase them out of their unwelcome spot. And then the hawks would catch them. And if I could get back there and retrace those steps and imagine where the rabbits and the red-tailed hawks would meet in that predatory act, I could steal a rabbit. And I pulled that off. And the first one I took home to my grandmother, all proud as punch about it, and she was going to cook it, and she got really upset at me that I had stole this rabbit away from a hawk. And a few years later, she told me why she got upset, and she was upset at me that, because she knew I had planned to do this for several years, that if I could pull that off, I could rob banks.
Oh, no.
So it was a moral statement that if I were going to do this again, you know, it's kind of a sense of fair play. With my little pocket knife, I would cut the rabbit up. I would take the back legs and leave the rest of the rabbit for the hawks. They would come back and then take possession of it, which later on became a great technique for trapping hawks when we would trap the wild ones and train them.
Right. Okay. So talk to us, how long, going back into the evolutionary time frame, tell us how early man, how this all developed from falcons to working with dogs to all of that process, which is so fascinating.
Yeah. And we talked briefly about that. And this is kind of my preoccupation now, is trying to recreate and imagine that. And I believe it happened early on when man was probably moving from one kill site with lions and tigers and wolves, as we're kind of scavengers. And we liked the idea of proteins and fats. And when that hawk would streak across the sky and catch something, and that screaming rabbit would, you know, a lot of people don't even understand why a rabbit screams. And every one of your dogs that you have, they hear that screaming rabbit, or somebody that's hunting with predator call. What happens is the odds are it's an eagle, hawk, or falcon that's catch the rabbit. It screams. Coyotes, wolves, and humans hear that. And you move toward the sound. And you get there, and the predator on the ground, the hawk or eagle, doesn't want to fight with you. Let's go to the rabbit and runs, and you catch the rabbit that's injured.
Right.
And at that kind of point of scaring that hawk off and taking that rabbit, that's a free meal. Time and energy budgeting means that you've got a meal that hasn't taken you out of your way of going to do what you were going to do, scavenger off that next meal. And I believe that is almost a mythological instinct in our heads that everybody is attracted to. And that's the beginnings of falconry. You watch bird watchers. I've led lots of bird watching tours. I've been president of Audubon Chapter. Everybody's interested in seeing the predators fly. And I think that emotional energy of looking to the sky and looking for predators harkens back to that time.
Wow.
That very moment.
Right. And so through history, there's a lot written, there's a lot depicted of noblemen and certainly the regular guy, right, that would hunt.
Yes.
And so they would capture a raptor and they would train it to hunt for them. Is that correct?
It even goes before then. I've done this a number of times over the years. Let me create this image for you, and we'll cut right to the imagery. There's alfalfa, and there's a farmer that's going to cut alfalfa. And weeks ahead of time, he's looking at the alfalfa, and he knows approximately when he needs to cut it. And then he gets his tractor ready, changes the oil, moves his tractor out. The day he goes out to cut the alfalfa, all the redtails show up, the marshhawks show up, the ravens show up. The magpies show up, the crows show up, the coyotes sit on the hillside, and as he goes along and mows, all of those microtus mice are exposed in the wake of that farmer.
Right.
And those wild hawks out there, and even bald eagles, are dumpster diving behind that tractor. And they all show up on that day. Everybody has a memory of that from the year before. That is falconry. Before we even trained the birds were following us. Before we had horses, as we were moving through a landscape, scaring up small birds and mammals in our path. And as we move beyond that safe distance, they drop down and kill it. And if we're so inclined, we can go back and take it away from them.
Mm-hmm.
And just like it happened with me as a little kid, those red-tailed hawks knew that when I took their rabbit away from them, I didn't take it all away. I left an offering behind. And as I moved on, they knew I wasn't coming back. And that trained relationship is an ecological phenomenon that goes on almost unseen.
Wow.
You know, a herd of cattle,
mm-hmm.
deer, elk moving, sheep through a landscape, rodents being moved, hawks moving in, coyotes following.
Right.
And it's trained. Everybody knows the rule.
And so from that sort of evolutionary beginning, then you are in a position and you start to, like so many things that early man does, right? We figure out tools, we figure out dogs, we figure out all kinds of stuff, right?
And the tool, in this case, is a behavioral tool. And I think it first started within an extended family and the relationship with people and dominance hierarchies, and then with the wolf being domesticated. However, that happened, and then once that concept of that ecological relationship, see, imagine the evolution of the domestication of the dog. It happened without chains.
Right.
It happened without nylon rope. You know, it really was a behavioral dance where all members can run away.
Right.
I mean, literally run away, and it had to be a symbiotic relationship. So the rules of how you train something is like learning how to dance. It's a totally cooperative two-way street. There has to be a symbiotic relationship that you can get out of it. How the birds were trained in that relationship probably went on for tens of thousands of years before we captured the first one and tied it up with string and then to begin to hunt it.
Right.
And when that occurred, after the domestication of the dog, than hunting with birds that you train and hunt with, turn loose and get them back.
Right.
The idea of getting them back, then the whole cultural tradition of doing it, just like you so accurately pointed out, before guns and we're having bow and arrows, and if I can send a hawk out to capture the quarry, it's much more efficient than using a bow and arrow.
Right.
But the behavioral relationship of a symbiotic relationship has to be established. And when that's done, falconry has been pre-recorded history that, you know, kings and queens and potentates and commoners have been practicing. As a matter of fact, the UN in the cultural heritage has now established falconry as a part of the cultural heritage, especially those in Europe, Middle East, China, Mongolia. And it looks like falconry came out of those big grassland herding cultures.
Wow.
Where every day you watch it happen, or you're herding your sheep, your yaks, your progenitors of the modern cow, goats, the herders are watching to the sky, and you're not just a hunter and gatherer anymore. You're managing the ecology of that grasslands with your herding animals. And if you want proteins and fats, you see the eagle fly and catch something. You hear that scream, especially young shepherds that are out. There's an instant meal.
Right.
And then you capture them. You're very much like with the domestic dog. And that training, the mythology that goes along, passed from generation to generation, it's literally in our soul.
And so tell us a little bit about how you do that, from acquiring, raising up, and then how do you work with it with the dog? Again, we're in pure dog talk. So, I mean, I'm fascinated by the birds of prey, but let's talk about that nexus with people and dogs and birds.
Yeah. Let's first bring it up to modern day. And that falconry is the most highly regulated federally and state field sport that there is. To be able to participate in hunting, lots of regulations. You have to have sponsors and mentors. The National Falconry Association is affiliated to other state organizations. And within the traditions, culturally, within the traditions of Europe and the Middle East and through Mongolia, those traditions have literally been passed down verbally and in books and how to train them. And I learned at a time you could have pets, and I imagined falconry, and I saw the first thing was the National Geographic of Life of an Indian Prince with the Craighead brothers during the 30s, right before the Second World War. They went to India with the Maharajas that were there and learned the cultural traditions of India. And those traditions were then written down in a number of books, especially coming out of Europe, England, Holland, Germany, Italy, Spain, and then the Middle East, kind of unbroken tradition there of flying the birds. And so all of that got codified in North America into a strange sort of egalitarian thing that happened in North America. And instead of it being monitored by very sophisticated, wealthy people and the hierarchies of Europe and England, for example, there are a whole bunch of country kids like myself and a bunch of other falconers coming out of the 30s and 50s that it was the natural history relationship was that instinct was there. And we started keeping them as pets. You look at the books and the tapestries of Europe, they're just the imagination they could hunt with them. And we literally figured it out on our own. And then with the conservation movements and DDT and the endangered peregrine and bald eagles, then it was codified legally. And so federally and state, you have to have a sponsor, and then you have to have the Department of Wildlife, let's say in the state of Washington, will inspect your muses and that you're qualified. Take a written exam, and for several years, you're a novice under tutelage. And then you become a general falconer and then a master falconer. And to take the first birds, you have to take them out of the wild and train them and to capture them. And now we go back to that ancestral instinctive part. Is that the nutshell of it is the birds learn to eat from you and eat in your presence, and they learn to fly to you. Keeping it with dogs, the same thing. The dogs have a social component, but there's a big food component to reward them for behavior. Same thing with the raptors. You've got dogs, you need to evaluate their behavior to the point where you can trust them off a leash or out of your yard. And you have a recall. We do the same thing with our birds. And they have a recall with an expectation they can fly back and land on her fist and derive a reward for that. And in the training, just like with dogs on a leash, for them to get used to be restrained by a leash, we do the same thing with the birds with jesses on their legs and it tied to a perch. And so it becomes a slow, non-negative reinforced activity. Dogs are social. And you can use negative reinforcement, but modern psychology shows that if we use more and more positive reinforcement, those behaviors can be solidified better. Well, it really has to be that way in raptors.
Right.
Because we have no social connection. It literally has to be all through positive reinforcement.
Hang tight, guys. Got a little bit of information for you. We'll be right back to the podcast in a minute. Heads up, crew. Join our patrons today. Get immediate access to the support of a closed Facebook chat group, special patrons-only episodes, free mentoring sessions, and more. Just like the NPR of dogdom, Pure Dog Talk brings you the news, the knowledge, and the insight to succeed with your purebred dog. In exchange, our Pure Dog patrons share the love with monthly or annual gifts, and that helps defray the cost of overhead and sort of keeping the MP3s rolling, you know? Hit me up, Laura at puredogtalk.com, and I'll hook you up with the details. You were talking about operant conditioning, like straight out operant conditioning working with the raptors.
Yes. And when I was in college, I was interested in the behavioral aspects of ecology. When you look at a landscape and the ecological relationships, and most of ecology has to do with energy movement from grasses into herbivores, into predators, and all those myriad paisley relationships. Well, I became interested in the behavior relationship that's going on. You can watch cattle graze, sheep graze, but how do they make their choices, which to eat and what not to eat? You can see that behavior occur right up against the fence line and trying to move beyond that. Well, I became interested in the relationship between predator and prey and the behavior. And falconry for me is literally a behavioral tool, just like a microscope is to see a world you can't see. You magnify it. Well, falconry allows me to participate in that predator-prey relationship. Every time I turn the birds loose, it's just like it occurs in the wild. And with that example I used as a little kid, I can choose to be an active participant, flushing the quarry, or I can step back and with my dog. The relationship between dogs and raptors, and I'm really sensitive to this, and this is why I'm very much interested in the versatile breeds like the wire hair.
Right.
And that they hunt fur, feather, water, and all of those environments when the genetic progenitor of the dog were hunting, there were goshawks following them. There were peregrines following. There were gerfalcons following. There were eagles following him. And in those crepuscular, owls will follow dogs and coyotes through the woods. Mm-hmm. I've seen this happen many, many times. And the dogs, the genetic progenitor, they know that those other predators are following. So when I've got puppies and I'm raising puppies, I'm looking for, are they aware of not just me, but are they aware of the chickens in the yard? And can they make the distinction between a chicken and a hawk, mm-hmm, or a rabbit and a cat? You know from your own dog,
right,
when they encounter a cat as to a rabbit, they know the difference right as puppies.
Yep.
You know, I've got cats in my house, so I'm evaluating my puppies when they're raising. Can they make cross species, almost brainstem recognition, just like me as a little kid of a hunting hawk? There are some of these dogs that already have their images. Their falconry relationship is already established. You would think that you've got a strong retrieving animal like a lab or a wire hare that we need them to retrieve. Now you're shooting pheasants or you've got them on point and you're teaching them to retrieve, that they're going to go in and kill your hawk. You have to deal with that, but it's surprising how quickly they don't retrieve your hawk.
Yeah, don't retrieve the hawk. That's good. That's lesson number one, don't retrieve the hawk.
That's right. And you would think it takes a lot of training. It takes a lot of observation. And as the puppy's growing up, and if you don't have a puppy that's been exposed to it, and I get a dog that's just been a gun dog, because over my hunting career, you know, raising a family, going and buying expensive hunting dogs just wasn't in the cards. So I got a lot of secondhand dogs and dogs out of the pond. But I got really good at seeing those dogs, if they had those evolutionary brainstem images in their heads, just like how everybody's interested in raptors. Mm. And do they have that ability to see that hawk and know that when I can have them retrieving pigeons, go in the water, retrieve ducks, and then my falcon is on the ground or my goshawk is on the ground on a lure, do they run up and grab it?
Right.
And just within moments, I can tell whether they've got it or not.
Right.
And I may have to, you know, negative reinforce, no, you don't want to go in. Or the best one is, you've got an old red tail or a female goshawk that
right,
already trained several dogs. The dog goes in too quickly. They come off it. They grab them by the muzzle. They let go and can take possession of it. And the dog Is it going to take one or two lessons to be learned?
Right. Yeah, that would be a pretty good lesson for most dogs. And so, you know, yeah. I think I have always been fascinated way back a million years ago when I was a kid. My parents sold a wire hair pointer to a fellow in Eastern Oregon that hunted with falcons. And I just was like mesmerized by the concept. So give us one of your images, because they're really beautiful, of you and your versatile dog out hunting for whatever it is you're hunting for and how that troika works, you and the dog and the raptor.
It starts at home. This is a well-oiled, well-orchestrated dance. The dog knows what it's doing. The hawk knows what it's doing. I've organized my time because when you go out hunting with a hawk, it doesn't end with you cleaning your gun and going home, you know, when you're done, because you could lose your hawk.
Right.
And the hunt, it takes on this natural history perspective that it'll go over a horizon. And if the dog's really into hunting with a hawk, you can cover just huge expanses of ground. And it's not like shooting a shotgun and you're within, you know, 100 feet, 200 mm-hmm. feet. Now you're taking up areas of, especially if you're hunting upland game birds. So let's say you've got your wire hair, you're used to hunting Hungarian partridge, which we have in eastern Washington, and everybody knows. So at home, in the normal picking up your leash, you know how your dog gets excited picking up the leash, and the dogs are watching, but when I pick my falcon up and I hood it and I'm putting it out in the car, they get really excited.
Right.
So we drive out into a suitable area. We already know the topography, where the quarry is approximately, and we turn the dog loose, and then they start working. They go on point, and then we assess, unlike with a gun, we go in and then we move in to make the flush. So if we're not really certain that that's a point, we don't turn the falcon loose.
Okay.
We really have to trust that dog.
Right.
And is it really, really honest? And then put the falcon up. The falcon circles, looks down. It literally recognizes the dog's point.
Mm-hmm.
Really recognizes it and reads the cover. Some of the birds, even as they mount up, they'll anticipate the direction in which the flight's going to occur. And then depending on the topography, the higher the bird is, the greater cone of vulnerability to the quarry. And so when they stoop, wind direction has a huge impact. And whether you want to flush downwind, crosswind, where the cover is, so you're assessing all of those things. Unlike when I'm hunting with my gun, it really doesn't make a lot of difference.
Right.
But when I'm hunting with my falcons, it makes a huge difference whether it's going to be successful. They mount up to whatever the acceptable height is for the quarry. And then depending on my dog, the reason I like wire hairs is that they've been selectively bred for just not one particular behavior. And so I can train them to point and I can ask them to flush and then move and flush. I can hold them up, give them a halt, and then we can move the field around again and wait for the falcon to take a different position, because especially with pheasants, they're always creeping and moving on you.
Right.
And even huns will do that. Or if I haven't read the point correctly, and there may be, you know, 200 feet for the birds, so it might take several times before we get everything pulled up. And then the birds will flush prematurely in an unanticipated direction. And then the falcon stoops. So I'd like to have the dog, my pointer, to wing and shot when the birds flush, not to break point.
Right.
And then we watch whether the falcon was successful. It's not. Then hold the dog up, wait, move back on point, and then sit there and watch the falcon go over the horizon and then wonder if it caught anything. And if it didn't, they'll come back and mount up again and get above the point. And then when the falcon stoops, many times it'll hit the quarry and injure it. And then the quarry will go down and cover. And then I've got to assess whether to send the dog in to get another point or to do a reflush.
Right.
So the coordinated activity with the dogs, they have to be really smart.
Right.
They can have all the instincts, but if they don't have the ability to handle, it's like moving jello around in the field. And so the falcon catches the quarry down on it. The dog can't go running in because I've got to decide is if this is a new falcon, does it understand this particular dog? They have to recognize each other. So I'd like to be able to have the dog lay down a good 50 feet away, lay down and not be a threat. Because in the wild, there's a strong instinct for these birds. When they kill something on the ground, they're now vulnerable to coyotes,
right.
Fox, badger, golden eagles coming over the horizon. So there's a natural history moment to watch that play out. And that falcon that's on that pun in this example we're creating, it has to totally trust the dog. It's not coming in. And after months or years of hunting with them, especially the falcons we, like prairie falcons, I've hunted a lot with, that are in the wild, that are fearful of all the coyotes. But now they develop a relationship with this one dog because that falcon figures out when that dog's around, there's never a coyote comes in. Mm-hmm. No golden eagles come in.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this hunting trust that begins. You switch the dogs up of a different color, that falcon won't behave in the same manner.
Interesting. Okay, and so does the falcon then bring you the prey?
Well, usually it's too heavy.
Right.
And when they catch it, it's difficult for them to pick it up. A female prairie falcon, a hen, they can pick it up in 500 yards or so. And this is where the trust comes in. The instinct is to catch it. Now you've got a human and a dog on the ground, and the strong instinct is to pick it up and fly away.
Right.
Because they think they're going to get ripped off.
Right.
So in the training of the falcon and the dog, the falcon realizes that when it catches it, it's their meal, and they're going to get the chance to eat that. And that the humans that are there, the dogs that are there, are protection from all these other really brainstem instincts of everything sneaking up on them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it happens to be a body of water, is it going to be a mink or an otter that could come out that's heard the fluttering feathers? Or even the sound of a falcon stooping, hitting its quarry will cause other ground predators to move in that direction. So when they're on the ground, all of this natural history ends up playing out. And the dogs, they have to have the instinct to retrieve, but the intelligence is way more important than the hard point. Because as you know, you can have a dog that has a really good instinctive point, but there's a lot to be taught after that.
Oh, yeah.
And they can find game. But can you move the game in the direction of the wind and be able to bring them out and then reposition them again? And in falconry, that's a huge deal.
Right.
Because you're not just carrying a shotgun with linear behavior. This is natural history at its best, and it's constantly changing.
And so does the falcon allow the dog to come and retrieve it to you, or do you go and take it from the falcon?
I go and take it from the falcon.
Okay.
And we're really good dogs, and the falconer understands that the dog can go right up to the falcon and lay down right close to it.
Mm.
And we like to actually get that developed because some flights can literally go out of sight.
Sure.
And I can't run as fast as my dog. And I would like to get my dog over the hill where my bird is, because golden eagles and red tails and prairie falcons will come in and kill your birds. Or in that crepuscular hour, great horned owls will come out of thickets and come in. And if your hawk is down in the swale and it's eating, the great horned owl or the eagle will get there and say, nah, I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to kill the hawk,
right?
Eat the hawk and eat the pheasant or the hen. I'm
right.
going to kill them both and eat them. And so the dog gets there and knows to get there and lay down. And now Amsel is really good at this. When she's there, she's looking over her shoulders. She's got a thing about coyotes. And she knows other raptors. She'll chase other raptors off. Yeah. These dogs are amazing.
Right.
Just absolutely amazing.
Awesome. It's just fascinating, Stephen. I really appreciate you sharing some of this imagery with our listeners, because I think for a lot of folks, this is way outside their, not necessarily comfort zone, but awareness and reality.
But the point is, they're aware of it and they're fascinated by it. Here about 2 years ago, there's a book that just came out a couple of years ago by Helen McDonald called H's for Hawk. And in that book, she talks about the death of her father and the psychological problems she was going through. And she trains a goshawk. And it's a literary tome about the underlying kind of relationship that falconry can have. And I was asked to give a presentation at a local grange. And normally I'm talking about natural history and conservation issues. And falconry is just the fact that I've got the birds there. It's under my falconry expertise that I can have wildlife here. And I have permits to do wildlife education and that sort of thing. And so I get there, and there's a whole line of people. And this is in the community. I've been here for 30 years. And who are all these strange people? And most of them were there because H is for Hawk.
Oh, wow.
And they didn't recognize me. So I left my falcon in the car, and I just got in line. And was wondering what was attracting to him. And there was several book clubs that had read the book.
Mm.
And here was a falconer that's going to give a talk. And it was because of that book. And to a person, they had these imageries of when they were kids about hawks and this fascination. And they thought it was about the kings and queens and potentates, but every one of them came down to, before they were even aware of the political history of raptors all over Europe and the Middle East, there are these primal beginnings that are there. And so people in general now, I'm really empathetic. I've had the privilege to do this at a very high level.
Right.
And then to see somebody stand in front of me and just with their eyes wide open, I now can remember that.
Right. Very cool. All right. Well, Steve, thank you so much. I've taken lots of your time and I appreciate it. You're very generous to share your stories. And I think the whole concept of what purebred dogs and the history that we have with them into the mist of time, I think is really, to me, always a fascinating little tidbit and kind of a side trip from some of the more nuts and bolts type things we do. So I appreciate it.
In this group that want this particular litter out of this particular breeding, because there's some really knowledgeable people like yourself that know about this line of dogs, and that there are three of us that are falconers that are, you know, where these puppies are going.
Mm-hmm.
And that mist of time thing, you know, through John Suggs and yourself,
right,
that have been involved with these dogs along, and then we've been recognizing these dogs because of the falconry connection, is that I turn the litter over to you. So they're raised right to get that beginning.
They are a treat and a treasure, and I think they are going to be wonderful for everyone to carry on some of that pretty special history. Natural history junkie. All right. Thanks so much. I sure appreciate it, Steve.
You bet, Lori. Have a good day.
You too. All right. Heads up, crew. Here's Petmate's tip of the week. What do? We travel with our dogs constantly. Thousands of miles. When I was handling, I drove something like 50,000 miles a year. We are insane the amount of time we spend in a car with our dogs. Keep them safe. Keep your driving safe from them distracting you. I know it's sweet when the dog sits with its head on your arm, but if there's a wreck, if there's an instance that you have to react, that dog is not safe. If it's loose in your vehicle, it can run away. It can get killed. It can take your eyes off the road and cause the accident. Put your dog in a dog crate when you're traveling. Petmates Plastic Kennels are a safe and secure home for your dog. Check out special savings just for you at www.puredogtalk.com/partners. And then use promo code PUREDOG for a special price break. As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our dog show superintendents are the hardworking people who make the dog show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the super's desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk.